Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 11 of the Chris Chambers Noir Show, where this award-winning best-selling author shines a light on some of the top writers in this powerful genre. This month, we shine a light on Todd Robinson, creator and editor of the pivotal hard-boiled noir magazine Thuglit, and also an award-winning author, and special guest Rob Hart, the USA Today best-selling author of the Assassins Anonymous series. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV, and you can also listen on Spotify, iHeart, and Apple Radio. And of course, all of the episodes are on ChrisChambersNoir.com. Take it away, Chris.
Thank you so much. Wow, this is exciting. Again, we're on Spotify, our iHeart Radio Network, Apple Podcasts, and of course, our pretty faces on YouTube. That's the payoff right there. Especially when you've got such a pretty person as Todd here, that, you know, I just, you know, isn't he pretty? And he makes the best Manhattan in Manhattan. So we can stop there. But no, we're going to keep on. I am so happy to have you guys here. Rob, as special guest to help us kind of highlight and showcase this young gentleman here with the hat and the beard. Rob's latest book, Three Hitmen and a Baby, little baby Lucia's, you know, adventures. Fresh, daisy fresh off the presses. What came out, what, like 2 weeks ago, Rob?
June 16th.
Oh, okay. Close. Daisy, not quite daisy fresh, but fresh enough off the presses. Yeah. Of course, Assassins Anonymous, The Warehouse, Medusa Protocol, short fiction. Nominated for about every possible award. And you did you do a Star Wars thing?
I did do a Star Wars short, which was pretty awesome. Scariest short story I ever agreed to in my life, because I realized like, oh no, the Star Wars people are gonna read this very closely. But, you know, a good segue too, because, you know, Todd was the one who gave me the idea for it.
There you go.
Because they asked us to pick characters from the Empire, and Todd was like, "Oh, you should do the guy with the ice cream thing, the Cantono, Lil Ro Hood." And I was like, yeah. "Oh yeah." And then when I asked them, I asked the editors if anyone had called dibs on them yet. They were like, "Actually, we're really surprised to say that no one has." So, I mean, this is why I tip well at Todd's bar. It's because you know he's responsible for my career and my success.
Okay. Well, we're going to touch on that, and please feel free to jump in when we start talking about that at in detail. So Rob is going to help us basically, you know, dissect and discuss this young gentleman here, Big Daddy Thug, Todd Robinson, author of the Boo and Junior books, the hard bounce, Rough Trade, Cassandra. That, look, before we get into details, I mean, Todd, would you characterize at least the Hard Bounce and Cassandra as kind of whodunits? Because they're like, I know they're hard boiled noir, but I mean, but they're basically, they're not caper novels. These two dudes are looking for somebody, and this is a question somebody fed me. I don't think they're whodunits, but somebody says that when somebody's looking for somebody, that's a whodunit. What's your opinion on that?
I don't know if I have a classification in that sense. I just try to do something different with, you know, the existing framework of crime fiction. You know, I always try to do something a little differently than anything that I have personally seen come before it. And with Hard Bounce or Cassandra, which is the French title, it's the same book.
Right.
I just wanted to go at it from a different angle. I mean, I call my personal style idiot noir, which, you know, Wikipedia defines the type of story that I do as the idiot plot, which is a type of story that can only move forward if one or more of the characters are idiots. And, you know, I just messed around with the framework a little bit of a traditional crime fiction story. I mean, whodunit is a really broad term and a little bit of an archaic term as well.
Right. No, you're right. Yeah. I just want to get your opinion, because somebody said, you're asking what those are who done. I'm like, all right, Jesus.
I mean, I guess in the broadest sense, you could consider a whodunit. I mean, what I did with my guys is, if you take the guys, Boo and Junior, who were my characters, right, my stock characters, they'd have been the goons in somebody else's novel.
Right.
You know, they'd have been the guys sent after the private
detectives around
to get him off the case. I'm like, well, what if the goons tried to be the heroes for once?
Oh, yeah. So hold that. I mean, there's another reason I asked that. We're going to get back to like common themes here. You're also got Blood, Guts, and Whiskey, Sex, Thugs, and Rock and Roll. There was a Christmas issue of Thuglit, too. What was that called?
Cruel Yule.
Cruel Yule. Love that.
That was just a separate short anthology that we were messing around with Christmas crime stories.
That was cool. So I usually do an evil icebreaker and a nice icebreaker. The evil icebreaker, I was going to ask you guys about spending time together with a stomach virus or something like that, because it triggered me. I tell Jim Latoile, who's a best-selling author in our genre, who grew up in the corrections system in California. I said, "Look, I'm not a tough guy, but I couldn't survive prison or jail, not for the reasons you think. I could take a beating. I could even give a beating. I could go hang out with the shot callers. I could even make a machete out of my shin bone. The one thing I don't like is the funk." And I would die in prison over the funk. And that's why this story triggered me so. I mean, you guys obviously survived.
Barely.
All
right, see, there you go. I mean, was it a hotel room? I mean, what was this?
Okay, so what happened was, you know, Rob and I had an event together in Boston years ago. And, you know, Rob in his ignorance just hates all things Boston because he's from Staten Island. So he's already jealous of New York City.
Boston is a nonsense city. It's a nonsense city. It should not exist. Continue.
So I am showing Rob the delights of the city. I'm going to take him down to Faneuil Hall. And it's a beautiful day. It's like mid-80s, gorgeous. And I got him a really nice lobster roll, some nice chowder. And then out of nowhere, the day just skews left and goes up to 96 degrees, humid and hot. And we've got stomachs full of mayonnaise and heavy cream. And it is not pretty. And we get back to the hotel and the two of us, three shades of green. And we got one bathroom. And I think that's the rest of it is. Yeah. Well, again, we had to coordinate because what was just in the toilet last? Was it your face or your ass? Because my face is going in there next. And I don't want it in there.
You coordinate that. That's what waste paper baskets are for, man.
It definitely improved our communication skills in a big way. Like, yeah. I felt definitely like we communicated much better after that trip.
Wow. But yeah, nothing's going to test your friendship faster than that.
You could put the white stuff
on the schedule on a whiteboard. Who goes where?
Yeah, you're like, look at the wonders of Boston. All our food is drenched in heavy cream and mayo. Come on.
Exactly. It's called class.
Or beans.
Called class, you dilettante.
Oh, my God. That
was a rough night, man. It was like, yeah. And we also, we're in the hotel that I'm pretty sure, like, it's one of those hotels you walk into and you're like, multiple people have been murdered here. Like, this place was like the American Horror Story Hotel.
And yet, which, if you remember... Our favorite review of the hotel.
How to get in the door.
Yeah. Well, that was because we were drunk.
What was the review of the hotel?
Oh, the review was, it was a one-star review of the hell that said, disappointingly not haunted.
Which, it's one of those places you walk in and you're like, oh, this is going to be a fun night. But yeah, when we got back to the hotel, we were both like pretty lit up and we were trying, like I think I was trying to use the key card on the door and it wasn't working. And we stood there for 5 minutes until finally, I think you just opened the door and we were
I very sarcastically like moved you out of the way to show you how it's done. And then I couldn't open the door.
So at least it had a key card. It wasn't like, you know, old fashioned crazy shit. No, there was some redeeming value to this place, but my God.
We had two key cards. Neither one of us could figure out how to make the key card make a beeping sound until one of us, and I couldn't even tell you if it was you or me, Rob, one of us just pulled the door and it was open the whole time.
For a hotel like that, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. They didn't even bother locking the door at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh my God. I love it.
We are not clever men.
No.
We're spirited, but we're not clever.
All right. Well, let me move to the next icebreaker. You both like Supergirl. I like Supergirl. Why did this movie get so much hate? Is it because it's girl in the title? Is
that because it has a girl in it?
Yeah. Well, there's going to be a certain level of chud that aren't going to be happy with any female-led superhero movie. That's just it. But there were some really negative reviews coming from sources that should have been better than that.
Yeah.
Major media sources. Like I think like Vanity Fair, which generally seems to write pretty even-headed reviews, just like slagged it. And I'm like, I remember sitting there watching it and I'm kind of waiting like, all right, when's the turn? When is this all going to fall apart? And like, and granted, like I'm watching it with my daughter. So like, I'm kind of seeing it through her eyes too. Yeah. And she's loving it. She's 11, my stepson's there. He's loving it. He's happy that Lobo is there.
Yeah.
There are probably ways in which like it kind of is fitting into that framework of how a superhero movie is like usually structured. But, I I've seen other movies get slammed for that before. Like, oh, it's paint by numbers. But it's like, well, that's the system. That's what we have.
Yeah.
Like, were you expecting like the Citizen Kane of superhero movies? Like, no, it's like, Supergirl meets John Wick.
Yeah, they want Robert Downey Jr. in it, and then that's it. Then it's the greatest film ever made.
Yeah,
yeah. Is it the James Gunn thing? But everybody knows going into it, it's going to be a little wacky because of him. So I mean, I don't get it.
Well, I came in a huge fan of the source material, which is the Tom King run,
right?
And I knew there were some things they had to change. I was hoping other things they weren't going to change, but I understood why they did. But those were my only criticisms. I'm like, I would have liked to have seen that, but I get why they didn't go with that.
Yeah. I thought that was great.
Tom King is absolutely the best at what he does, which may have been part of the other problem, too. Tom King, as a writer of comic books, has an ability to take established characters that we all know, they've existed for 50 years or more, and he makes you observe them from 2 feet to the left of where we've previously stood.
Right.
And he gives you a fresh take that absolutely feels honest to their origins, that feels honest to their characters. And he really did that in the graphic novel, and the movie does a very good job of doing that as well. But I think a certain number of people still have this idea in their head that Supergirl is going to be, smiling, all-American blondettes who stands next to Superman and has no agency or character of her own. This really gave her that, especially with the history of her growing up on the planet that was dying. She witnessed all that. That's going to affect someone, and no one.
It's
going to
make you a little triggered. Yes, a little PTSD-ish.
Yeah, I didn't get what I expected, so now I'm going to be a pain in the ass about it.
Yeah, although some of them probably wanted Sydney Sweeney or something crazy like that, but. Be that as it may, I'm going to jump now to my raison d'etre here. I mean, the rebirth of Hard Boiled, an interview with its midwife, and I have to tell you, I came up with the midwife part because I was talking to Peter Rosofsky, who, as you know, is Shutterbug and inventor of noir at the bar, and I said, is Todd the mom? Is he the uterus of the rebirth of Hard Boiled? Is he the dad? Now people could say he is the dick.
a lot of people will tell you I'm a dick, dude. Trust me on that.
Yeah, so
you will not find a shortage.
And I said, no, maybe not. I said the midwife, and midwife was a good good term. So I'm going to give him credit there for that. But for me personally, I would rename this. This is a long time coming. Because for me personally, I remember back in the day, I had a friend in New York, Jerry Rodriguez, who was a Puerto Rican.
No, Jerry.
Hard-boiled. Yeah, he had Revenge Tango. I was about to blurb that book, and then he died. And a lot of things were going on at that point. He died, and then my agent said, why don't you write in this kind of up-and-coming, burgeoning subgenre called domestic suspense, and as an African-American male, it would really go over well. And I said, hell no, fuck no. So the combination of those and Jerry expiring and that, there seemed to be just this void. And we had our standard bearers, and there's a Latin phrase. I don't know what it is in Latin, but it was the Roman legions used to say, "Thank God for the final line." These were the grizzled veterans, and it was whatever that is in Latin. I didn't go to Catholic school, but it was if the final line of veterans, the grizzled line, breaks, then we're fucked. And we had that final line and standard bearers for a long time. And my mentor, George Pelicanos, Dennis Lehane, Ace Atkins, people I like, Richard Price, Wallace Strobe, Reed Farrell Coleman, and then my boys, Gar Anthony Haywood and Gary Phillips. But the line was exposed, and there had to be a new line, a new group of people coming in to stand there. And Thuglit, in my opinion, was what created that new line. And I mean, you want to go down the line from Sean Cosby to Jordan Harper. Even people, had, a career, but I mean, Terrence McCauley, Angel Lewis Colon, Jen Conley, my girl, Nikki Dolson, Eric Pruitt, Rob Hart, to mention a few, Travis Richardson.
Yeah. Hillary Davidson. And,
well, didn't you publish Megan Abbott like way back in the day when you were digital only?
Nope.
I thought you did.
No, I published your mom a few times.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, published your mom, William Boyle.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so there was that, so that's why I say a long time coming. And the only real memorialization of this, I think, was Jim Qualey's article, I think, in Prime Reads, and that was really short. And it's got some good quotes from Rob and some good quotes from Sean Cosby. But, I mean, you brought back one of the legs. I mean, if you look at million years ago, Edgar Allan Poe invents our genre. And basically it was just three legs originally. There was cozies, police procedurals, and kind of hard-boiled noir. I mean, you brought that leg back after it kind of got kicked out under us, but kicked itself too, because a lot of people were saying it's a violence, sexism, racism, despite, although, we got Donald Goines and Chester Himes,
Well, here's the thing. Too. Those things exist, and they exist in the world we live in. They exist, yes, in the world of crime. And to ignore the fact that those fucking things exist is being disingenuous and dishonest with a certain level of truth that I wanted to see in these stories. Because let's face it, I mean, I have managed to avoid a life of crime, but I've sure as shit been around it for a good part of my life. And I wasn't seeing that kind of honesty. I mean, even in some of the names that you mentioned, they're very talented writers, but they were stilted, or they were older, or they were writing from a place of being way outside and being observers to crime and just sort of telling it from a perspective that didn't feel like they'd had their boots in it at any point. And we were at a place where the short story market, no one was publishing. And again, if I'm going to be perfectly honest, it's the kind of stuff I was writing. Well, everybody's telling me nobody wants this. Nobody wants violence. Nobody likes when people use a bad word. And I'm like, well, that's because you're still selling and marketing to my grandmother. There is an audience hungry for these type of voices. There are these audiences that are hungry for this type of storytelling. And I was being told, no, there isn't, over and over and over again. And I'm like, well, let me, because it's the kind of stuff that I wanted to read too. I'm like, it's DIY. I'm like, I get a DIY my own fucking magazine to find stories that I enjoy. So be it. And so I did.
So, before we, I have you launch into, how you started it and what you were trying to accomplish. I was talking to Katie Nguyen and Mindy Carlson, who are here in the D.C. area with me. Great writers, great ladies, they're great friends. And they put the issue right in front of me that it wasn't a female audience for this stuff. It's just that it was, you need a broad audience, like Lake Okeechobee or Lake Pontchartrain, of women, not necessarily just a deep one. So if there was a deep audience already, but a broad one, no. And the publishers and the people running these magazines basically they just saw that and said, well, women aren't going to like this, and maybe tie it all to like Mickey Spillane and, you know, the sexism and not, you know, quote, knocking a broad around type stuff. And that's what it was painted with. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Rob, please jump in on that too.
I mean, look, like, no one in publishing understands anything. If anyone in publishing had an inkling of an idea how to sell a book, then every book would be a bestseller. You know, so when Amen. People say, oh, readers don't want this, they don't want that. Like, I always kind of feel like, I think about my first book, New York, which was like, you know, a hard boiled, you know, kind of like, you know, punk rock amateur PI book. And the number of my mom's friends who loved the book. And I'm like writing apologies when I'm signing the book. I'm like, sorry for all the bad words and the drug use and the violence. But like their readers are hungry for just good stories, you know, and it's this idea of like, we have to hammer it into an expectation of like, oh no, like domestic suspense or like, you know, for a while recently, like romanticism, if it's not romanticism, right. We don't give a shit. It's so short-sighted, but you know, and it makes me think of, I don't think that Henry Ford actually said this, but it's like, you know, that there's this quote attributed to him that, you know, if he asked his customers what they wanted for, he would have built a faster horse. And it's like,
yeah.
You know, that's, yeah. But that's what thinking is in a lot of creative spaces. It's like, okay, what's the faster horse? And I'm much more interested in like, no, I want to build a car. Let's build a car.
What about, I mean, Todd, you were nodding along. What do you?
Well, again, I only have my personal observations to go for this. I mean, because the thing that they kept saying to me was like, all of this is too masculine and men don't read. And I'm like, well, that's not true. But what is it about the fact that some of it, not all of it, some of it is, and again, that just, it's all over the place, that you think is upsetting? No one is more disrespectful to female readers than the publishing industry. It still carries them around like female readers are baby birds in a nest.
Exactly.
That the slightest breeze is going to blow out of the nest. And my exposure to, not even through the magazine itself, but through my own writing, which again had the same accusations, like women won't like this, there's men in it.
Right.
You know, and there's a way, I mean, you know, there's a masculinity without machismo. There's, you know, there's nuance to be found in all of this.
We're going to...
Because my two publishers in the United States were utter shitbags. They didn't do anything to promote it. If anything, they did everything they could to not help me sell this book. But God bless my French readers, and God bless Oliver Gallmeister over in France, where I got to learn what a good publisher is supposed to do for you.
Right.
And I remember they sent me on a book tour, and I was shocked because I had nothing but beaten into my head that women were going to hate what I do and hate what I write. And the number of female readers of all ages who embrace this book was legitimately shocking me, because I fell under the spell of what American publishing tries to sell you. And that was when I was like, man, they have no respect for female readers. Fucking none.
Well, and that drives me nuts. We're going to get to that. We're going to get to Gallmeister. We're going to talk about some of these common themes where it is not, you know, ass whooping for ass whooping's sake. That's not what you're doing. That's not what any of us are doing. But I'm glad you brought that up as a good, you know, presage for what we're going to talk about. But let me get to the specifics of Thuglit. First of all, I have to fish this out of my drawer here. You know, this is what you paid me with. Todd, thank you very much.
And I was still, all I could afford to pay it.
Yeah, this is it. I think I gave it to KT Nguyen to do a noir at the bar at your place. And she's like, is it going to smell? And I'm like, no, it's been washed.
Oh.
You know, no, I washed it. I made sure I washed it before I gave it to her. Beforehand, yes.
Chris, I've been in a room with you a couple of times. I've never smelled you. I can't speak of my own.
I didn't get too close. I just kind of hung back and drank my Manhattan. But, you know, walk us through, you know, what was your aim in terms of giving some of these people some exposure? And, you know, because it's, I think Jen Connelly might, I hope I'm paraphrasing correctly, is that, you know, you gave us inspiration to write. That is a very powerful sentence. I don't know if it's a direct quote, but that's kind of the meaning. And that is, you know, in and of itself, you gave people inspiration to write. I mean, was that it right there?
I think that was an accidental byproduct. I really do think that was an accidental byproduct, because I started the webzine. It picked up a little bit of steam. I mean, let's face it, it never had a really broad readership. It's hard to push short stories in 2015, much less 2026. Because like I said, I mean, I wanted to read good stuff. I wanted to hopefully expose that there was a market for the kind of stuff I was writing. And I think where the accidental side effect became inspiration for other people was people for the first time found a market for the kind of things that they were doing instead of being told to sit in the corner because nobody wants what you do. I think I was one of the first people at that point. I think, honestly, in the same vein, Plots with Guns was doing that as well. So I took a lot of inspiration for the magazine from that. I mean, they were very, very niche with every story had to involve a gun. And I'm just like, just be fucking good. That's it. You don't. And that was a misconception, too. People thought that it had to be edgy or, you know, it's a borderline offensive at times. I'm like, no, I allow for those things. I allow for the violence. I allow for an element of sexuality. I allow for language. But you don't need that. Hillary Davidson's first story, Anniversary. Never going to forget it, man. And that was my ex-wife's issue, because she was one of my main editors, which is another thing, too. It was never 100% my aesthetic.
Right. Okay.
I had a couple of editors that were pivotal to the magazine that don't get nearly enough credit, one of which is my ex-wife, Allison Glasgow. And she has a very different aesthetic than I have. And I remember when she brought me Hillary's story, and I had the reverse response. I'm like, this almost seems too elegant and good for us. But man, was it a creepy. You meet Hillary, and she is just like sunshine walks into the room on two legs. And right. You'd be just shocked at the darkness of some of the things that she comes up with. And that story was dark. And I'm like, yeah, we're going with this.
Yeah, there's a lot. Of, I mean, I had Alex Kenna on the show a couple months ago, and this is small person with long hair, and it's just the dark stories. They're just dark stuff, and it is amazing. And when you're just talking to her, she's like, oh yeah, I took my kid there, and. These stories come from places I don't know, and I don't know if I want to know where some of these stories come from. But it's amazing to give them that kind of life, you know, in the online magazine. I mean, but Rob, I mean, you know, you weren't an editor, but you might as well have been, because you know, weren't you more or less contributing in every, you know, issue? It seems. I mean, you were like the bread and butter.
I mean, I will say, and look, like I've accomplished a few things in my publishing career that I'm pretty proud of. And I've been a bestseller. I've been nominated for awards, but the biggest feather in my cap, and I'm not blowing smoke, is the fact that I know that me and Jordan Harper tied for Thuglit for, we each got published 6 times and we were never rejected. And that's like, that feels good. But, you know, I just to spin off what Jen Connelly was saying, I mean, my experience with Todd, and I say this to Todd sometimes, and he's like, no, blah, 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 it's not true, blah, blah, blah.
I do say blah, blah, blah a lot. That is fair.
Yeah. But I remember when I was a little baby writer, you know, I the first time I met Todd was the Hard Bounce release, and I didn't know him. And it was a Mysterious Bookshop, and I had been working there, and... You know, the event was cool. And I knew his agent at the time, Stacia. And then Stacia was like, oh, and I think Matt McBride was in town.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, well, you know, we're all going up to the bar where Todd works, Shade. It's in the West Village and you should come. And I was like, okay. You know, I was scared. I didn't really know anybody. Literally got off the train, like got off at Canal Street. I'm like, nah, I shouldn't go. And then I'm like, no, stop being a baby. You should go to this. And I remember sitting at a table with you and Stacia pointed to me and was like, oh, he's a writer too. And you're like, cool, send me some. And I'm like, really? Like, it's that's
how it works,
you know? Yeah. And it felt like, you know, when you're a baby writer, you sometimes feel like everything is an ivory tower, that everything is, you know, some like insurmountable goal. And just to have like an esteemed editor who just had a book come out, say like, oh, just send me a story, gave me the confidence to say, yeah, I think I could do this. And previously I think I had a short out at Shotgun Honey previously, but that was like, you know, less than 900 words and it was digital only. And so Todd published my first like in print long form short story. And that kind of gave me the confidence to stick with it, because it was like that, you know, it's the dopamine hit, obviously, of, oh, look, like a thing that I wrote, like, is in print. This is amazing. But also just someone who, you know, was willing to take a shot on me and believed in me. And then I think I came to the bar and you paid me the $50 for the story or whatever, or $25 or whatever it was. And then I put it right back on the bar and just ordered some drinks. and we've been besties ever since. But, yeah, it was, you know, and that's the thing that I try to, you know, get across to Todd, is just how unbelievably influential he has been in terms of, you know, not just being able to see talent, not just, you know, because, yeah, there's a laundry list of people who have gone on to illustrious careers. It was being that lighthouse, like providing that boost of confidence that we all needed, by taking away a lot of that, like, you know, hoity-toity bullshit that comes with a lot of the publishing industry, and being able to make us feel like, no, we're all just here. We're all together. We're doing this. We're having fun. It's cool. Like, give me what you got.
Well, as I always say, rah, 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 rah.
Exactly.
Well, go ahead, Todd.
That was an unexpected side effect, and it's a thing that I can still do here and there. I have sort of really backed out of the world almost entirely. I don't go to conventions. I don't really do readings anymore. I've just backed the hell out of it for the most part. Mostly to save what little shreds of sanity I have fucking left. But, you know, I was not expecting the amount of people who were telling me that the existence of the magazine was motivating them, that how important it was for them, that at some point they got in there, that it was a white whale for something. I'm like, yeah, this is some shit I'm doing out of my living room, dude. I'm like, I'm glad. But the thing that I found, I did a reading a couple of years back, and I had a couple of writers, and I get this a lot from younger writers. They're like, man, I wish your magazine was operating today.
Exactly.
I wish I was writing back when it was. And there were two writers that just got on stage and delivered banger short stories. And one thing, and I went up to them, and I think you meet me for 10 minutes, you know I'm not going to blow smoke up your ass. But I went up to both of them separately, and I was like, if the magazine was still in existence, you would have been in with that story, full stop. And they just, you know, tears in their eyes that you know, and I'm proud of the fact that I can, you know, inspire these guys to keep going, because, man, it gets dark in this business for people sometimes.
Yeah, but here's the thing, and I want to go to the craft part, and I'm going to go to Rob. Do you think that this experience with Thuglit really helped you in terms of being a craftsperson in your later work, because you could pivot to a lot of things? I mean, the warehouse is not the same as Assassins Anonymous, you know, and the Ash McKenna stories are not the same as Three Hitmen and a Baby. I mean, so, you know, so I'm not trying to silo you, but I mean, did you develop some skills there, you know, with Todd showcasing you that you could, pivot into these other things and then move, you know, almost through subgenres. Even the Star Wars stuff, or that you did something with Alex Segura, I think too, which was sci-fi. Did any of that help you, that experience, or is this something that came about later?
I mean, in a general sense, I always kind of treated short stories as a proving ground, where it was like, okay, you know, I want to try a different technique. I want to try a different idea. I want to experiment with something. So I'm going to do it in a short to see if it works before like moving it over to a whole last book. I think the thing that I learned publishing with Thuglit was restraint. And I remember it was maybe like the third or the fourth story you published for me, Todd. It was the death row story and with the pizza. And that you and after I don't even think you clocked it immediately, but the issue had come out. You're like, you know what I realized is this is the only story I've ever published in which no crime takes place. And I was like, nice. And that made me feel good. And because I remember the first story I sent you was about two guys trying to knock over like an Asian massage parlor. Yeah. And so it was a little like, you know, it was a little goofy and a little over the top. And so it had a. You know, it was me being like, okay, cool. Like, let me push myself a little bit in that regard. But then over time, I was just like, you know, and I knew that that was not the case. It was like, I knew that a Thuglit story didn't need to be over the top, violent, sexual, anything like that. I knew that you wanted good stories. But I said to myself, like, let me see if I can start writing stuff that's a little bit more serious, but is still going to, so it's going to push me as a writer, but still appeal to you and your aesthetic. And I felt good about that. Every short story was a learning opportunity.
And that's how I always treated my own as well. It's like, that's where, you know, I experiment with tone. That's where I experiment with voice. It's where I experiment with character archetypes. And that's why I think the short story market being decimated, if not extinct at this point, it severely damages the craft.
There's a school of thought right now that, you know, some of these magazines are under kind of, you know, new management or fresh eyes, and that's not the case anymore, like with Alfred Hitchcock or Ellery Queen. I mean, there is that school of thought. The fresh eyes kind of school of thought. You're not buying this shit.
They're still called Alfred Hitchcock and Ellery fucking Queen. They're not called Quentin Tarantino or even Elmo Leonard.
Right.
Jesus Christ. And they do publish some good stuff. I'm not knocking any writer who gets in there. But who are you looking to? What is your market?
Right.
Who Ellery Queen is. You do. Rob does. But some of us by default, because it's the industry we work in, spend an afternoon in the bar and ask every single person who walks in who Ellery Queen is. They're not going to be able to tell you.
Right.
But it's this clinging to the old ways that just it's still the same fight. It's been 25 years. I still fight this fight about my writing. I'm like, trust me, this is fine. Nope. I'm fighting the same fucking fight no matter how many times the other writers, because again, they're the ones who prove me right. And that's where I'm grateful to the writers. And I can just sit back with my cigarette and be like, I don't need anybody to tell me I was right. I know I was. That guy just sold 1 million copies. That guy is on the USA Times bestseller list. This guy was just on the cover of the New York Times book review. And these people in the gatekeeping positions will still look me dead in the eye and be like, you're wrong. I'm like, oh my God, could you just try? And they won't, because publishing now is so controlled by the bean counters. They are so terrified. Like I said about Tom King, in the comic books, the comic books are braver than the publishing industry for novels. He says, take two steps to the left and look at it from a different angle. Publishing is terrified to take one step. Right. And that's the agents, that's the editors, that's the publishers. Maddening.
Well, I mean, so what makes Gallmeister different? I mean, is it because they love the war in France? Is it just a cultural thing? I mean, you know, they got bean counters in France too.
Not necessarily. I mean, obviously they're there, but the beautiful thing about at least Gallmeister, because they are my experience working over there, is they straight up, I had to ask them one day, it's like, what is it about what I'm doing? And they said the exact opposite of what anyone with any ounce of honesty in the American publishing industry will tell you. And they said, oh, we like you because you're doing something different. Where here you do anything different, you get pigeonholed as niche. They tell you, we don't know who to sell you to. The number of times I've gotten, oh, I love your book, but I have no idea who to sell it to. Why don't you sell it to people like you, you ding dong? You're the one saying you like it.
I mean, so it's no shock to you that on this side of the pond, some of the number one selling books on Amazon are already written by AI. I mean, it's not a question of that whether it, I mean, they, people know it's an AI book and they're outselling humans. I mean, that doesn't shock you.
Well, yeah, no.
Yeah.
Well, it's such a different literary tradition anywhere outside of the U.S., unfortunately. And Todd, sometimes I use this as an example where you say that, you know, you would go on tour to like these little towns in France and like, you know, the entire town would show up, not because they knew you, not because they read your book, but because you were an author. And right. And there was something to that. You know, I had that experience in Germany where the German edition of The Warehouse, my publisher over there did like some really, really cool events for me. And, you know, here I do an event in New York where I was born and raised, and it's like inviting people to a Tupperware party. You know, if I get like 10 people,
right,
that's great. And then I'm doing events in Munich and Hamburg where there's like 200 people, none of whom I know. None of them are, again, they're there for no other reason than that I wrote a book and that's special. And so I feel like sometimes you go to other countries and you get treated the way you thought you were going to get treated here. Where people take it very seriously and treat it with a level of import. Whereas here it's like, oh, that's sweet. You wrote a book again. I feel like when I tell people here, like if I meet someone and they're like, what do you do? I'm like, oh, I'm an author. I get one of two questions. It's like, do you self-publish or what's your real job? And I'm like, in fact, I am published by the biggest publishing house in the world and it's my full-time job. It's real. But people here just all there. There is an automatic assumption of like, oh, that's a adorable.
which in our subgenre is kind of ironic, you know.
Well, Rob said one of my favorite little incidences. It was my, you know, my first trip to France to promote Cassandra. I did a festival over the weekend, but the first little town, it was Olivet. I'm never going to forget it. This small town, and a bunch of people showed up, and I was just sitting there like, I don't know what the hell's going on. I don't know who these people are. One of the women, one of the first questions I got, they were like, well, why did you choose to come to our little town? And I was just like, well, you invited me. that's why I showed up. I got a ticket on a train to come here. I'm glad you guys showed up.
Let me ask you guys this, and I'm going to come back to like common themes. Let me start with Rob and set this up. I mean, you got Three Hitmen and a Baby. I've friends who thought it was a cozy just by looking at the cover.
That's funny.
And but it ain't. It ain't. I mean, there is this energy flow of humor in it that derives from Assassins Anonymous. I mean, the whole point of this, you know, encounter group or, you know, rehab 12 step of killers, you know, is funny. You know, it's funny. But you know, there isn't supposed to be humor in our subgenre. I mean, that's what some people do say. I mean, people who don't like it would say, well, wow, you know, maybe it is a cozy. There seems to be a cleverness, a humor to it. You know, almost, you know, this, oh, isn't that special that you're a writer kind of a thing. At the same time, I mean, the noir elements, the hard-boiled elements are there, and the thriller elements are all throughout there. Likewise, Todd, I mean, you know, you've got the Boone Jr. books that, again, I mean, these are people who very reluctantly choose violence, like Mark in Rob's book. I mean, you know, very reluctantly choose violence. They have to because they're in a violent world, but that's not their thing. I mean, do you guys...
You make me want to go get my blood pressure medication.
Right.
I might walk away and go get it right now because I feel my blood pressure.
Well, bear with me. I drove him away. He's getting his blood pressure. But look, I mean,
you're making me get my blood pressure medication.
You got the Monday thing. You got the M thing flipped up for the pills.
Dude, I'm on so much blood pressure medication. It's like I'm taking a brunch.
But I mean, but you guys, I mean, but you guys are writing almost against this trope that these characters are going to choose ass whipping like this, and that's what it's about. And it's not. I mean, you know, do you think that people just don't understand that in noir and hard boiled, that, you know, the stuff that we've kind of congealed here? I mean, it is about self-reflection. It is about self-questioning. It is about, no, do I, you know, I don't automatically choose, well, not just choose violence, let's say, not automatically choose lethality, when I put it that way. I mean, what do you guys think about that? I mean, you know, you guys are going for something deeper that the trope says isn't there. I mean, what do you say to people about that?
I think there's a degree. Look, like there's been times where I've picked up, you know, like hard-boiled noir books by people, and I've read them, and I'm like, oh, like, this is a tough guy fantasy. Like, you're not a tough guy, but you want to be a tough guy. So your character is the toughest of the tough guys, and all the ladies like him, and you know, like, he's the coolest of the cool. And I think Todd and I have a different approach, in the sense that Todd and I have, you know, experience with violence. Like, we've had experiences in our lives where, you know, we understand the weight and the gravity of it. Like, we don't go around, like, we're not the kind of people who go around looking for fights. Like, there was this, we went to go see the movie Abigail, like the vampire movie.
Right.
And there was like, there was some guy, like, you know, talking on his phone and talking to his friend and like practically yelling. And like, but we could both kind of tell, like, from his level of like machismo, that if we had asked him to be quiet, he would have picked a fight. And then we would have gone to jail. Like, you know, there's right. So the two of us just got up, walked out, asked for a refund, and went home, because it was like, you know what? Not worth it. Last night on the train, you know, we're taking the train back down to the West Village, and some guy's stomping around, and the two of us just started laughing. It was like, you know, we don't need, like, we understand that like pain has a price. And so we're not going to put ourselves in a stupid situation unless it's like a last resort or there's a really good reason. And so I think we come to it with I don't want to put down other authors, but we come to it with a certain degree of responsibility. Right.
Todd, what do you think about that?
Yeah, that was funny last night on the train, as young kid, just stomping, like, oh, you're adorable, you know, because I've come across a lot of real tough guys in my life, and you know what they don't do? They don't fucking advertise. They just exist.
Yep.
The toughest people I have ever met are some of the nicest as well, and I am talking like people of legend, and they're the nicest people, because they don't have to prove anything. As far as the genre is concerned, again, the genre contains multitudes, and I can't help with what I do, if I'm going to be honest with my voice, is keep a sense of humor out of that. And I've discussed this with other writers. I've discussed this with readers who seem surprised because they're expecting one aesthetic, but they get another. You know, one of the first people who inspired me to start writing, because I really liked the aesthetic of what he was doing, was Andrew Vax. And he is humorless. There was one joke in book number 6, and I almost fell out of my chair. But there's something to be said about that style and it having a place as well. It was so exaggerated that as someone who came up from a lifetime of reading comic books, that, you know, what Frank Miller did with Sin City, that there's a simpatico between those two voices.
Right.
And then I was one after the other. I read Andrew Vax, and then I read Elmore Leonard, who embraces that absurdity, who embraces that sense of humor, but also gets dark as hell.
Right.
And there is a place for both. And the thing that I talk to people about, where for me, the humor is inescapable. And, you know, my two characters, they're bouncers at a very violent rock and roll club, which is what I used to be. There's a lot of stress in that job. Now, when I'm talking about stress and job levels, bouncing is at the bottom of it. But if you've ever hung out with cops or firemen or career soldiers,
oh, yes,
they always have to tell their stories with a sense of humor, because that's a way of dealing with the stress. That's exactly the release valve for the amount of pressure. And I mean, these guys will tell you some, you know, these stories that'll knock someone else on their ass, but with a punchline at the end of it. Dennis Farina always said the most accurate TV show to ever portray cops was Barney Miller.
Wow. Okay. That's deep. Interesting.
He's like, you can't be this serious all the time as a cop
right.
without eating your gun within your first 2 years. And right. he was a Chicago detective for years.
Right. Wow. Let me put it this way then. I mean, let's say that it is a common theme or common thread between, say, Mark and Assassins Anonymous and Three Hitmen and a Baby and Boo and Junior. Is it something? I don't want to be too trite. I mean, is it redemption? Is it self-reflection? Or is it, can you boil it down to a word like that for either, you know, for either three of these people? What do you guys think? Am I reading too much into your characters?
Well, no, I don't think so. I'll let Rob take the forefront on this first.
Oh, yeah, no, I think, look, like I can only tell you where I was at in terms of, like, you know, writing Mark. It was like, I'm, you know, I hit my 40s and I'm like, okay, you know, there's stuff I've done that I'm really proud of and there's stuff I've done that I'm not so proud of. And I want to be a better person, you know, for myself and for my family and is change possible. And I'm going to explore through the lens of assassins in a 12-step recovery program for killers. Cause why not? But you know, and that's the thing that, you know, it's always been the funniest reaction. Cause I see this all the time is like people will read Assassins and then they'll like write a little review somewhere on like a blog or on Instagram or something. They'll be like, I wasn't expecting this to be so deep, like, and so thoughtful. And, you know, that's kind of the thing that sucks is that I think that what Todd and I do, yes, we're coming at it from a slightly bombastic place. And when we do, we're jokers. Like we like to make people laugh. We like to have a good time. We like our violence. But at the end of the day, like we're also like, we're two, like, you know, pretty emotional dudes. Like we have a lot of feelings. And, you know, I think sometimes people see genre fiction as like limiting in the sense that it's not digging deep into personal themes when it does. And it's just, I prefer it over literary fiction. Cause like, you know, when literary fiction characters are being contemplative, like they go look at a fucking tree. Like my character goes out and like gets in a fight. Like I'll take the fight over the tree.
Right. Todd, what do you think about that?
I mean,
I have a story there too.
You know, I think they're going side by side down the same highway with the things okay. that Rob and I explored in these. For me, you know, I still make the primary, I pay my rent by bartending to this day. You know, when I started writing those books, I was still doing security at bars and clubs in New York City. I came out of that in Boston. And for me, the idea that I was exploring with these two guys who are, you know, living their lives in a state of suspended animation and doing the same things every day, there's a bit of a man-child aspect, and I think that applies to a lot of people in the bar industry, men and women, and some people move past it, some people don't, because it's a fun job, it's an easy job for the most part, especially when it becomes rote for you and it's just your career at that point. But I wanted to take this idea of these two characters who have found this comfortable complacency in a very violent existence. It's like violence is part of their complacent existence because it was part of mine as well. It's like people always ask, oh, what do you ever get into fights, this, that, or the other? And I'm like, there have been so many of them that I don't remember half of them unless, you know, there's my stabbing scar.
Right.
The lump on the back of my head when I got smacked with a blackjack. Would you want to get, I'm like, people still carry that? I'm like, first of all, my first reaction was, ow. And then, really?
So like, that is pretty old school, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I wanted to take this idea of these characters who are not only forced to a degree to move forward in their lives, but to reflect back on the past that they've chosen to block out for one reason or the other, that the traumas of their past that they, you know, they've encased themselves in. But it's the same thing. It's not so much, you know, navel gazing as like right. Rob said. It's like, great. How many pages is he standing at the ocean side for?
No, go ahead. What were you going to say?
But it's also just the way any individual writer's brain works. You know, I, you know, one of my favorite writers that just because I will never, ever, ever write anything close to what this guy does is Cormac McCarthy.
Right.
I love McCarthy. And I think if you're a writer, you can, if you don't like Cormac McCarthy, then you don't know what the hell you're doing. Because he just always just blows me away. But I remember reading The Crossing, which is one of my favorites. And I was just like, man, this needs a werewolf. I understand
where you're coming from.
I have an outline for a novel, which is The Crossing with a werewolf in it. I wrote that whole shit out. I mean, that's the thing, too. That's where you find the inspiration in these other guys. Right. Like, what is it of my aesthetic that I would interject into theirs? Where everyone, every single one of us in this business is standing on the shoulders of giants. The problem is the industry just ignores some of the giants of the past, too. And why? Look at Miggy Spillane.
Right.
Look at how many books that guy sold. And he was writing by today's like almost comedically machismo
right.
crime fiction. It had a place. It has a place, if not only in history. And when they were asking about literary writers who look down on what he does, his famous quote when he sneered was like, people eat a lot more peanuts than caviar.
let me tell you the story. I might have told you this at the bar, but there was a certain, it was like two, three years ago. It was at the Edgars, so you know it's going to be funny coming up here at the Edgars. It's at the cocktail party, and a certain acquaintance of ours was nominated for a very high, you know, award there. A certain other person came in who I've known since he was a little boy, Pulitzer Prize winner, and it was also nominated. And he was just aghast at how nice and funny and cool everybody was. And this other person who we know was not too happy with this dude and said, you know what, man, we mystery crime fiction writers are wonderful people who write about horrible things. You all are horrible people who write about wonderful things. So that was his dig at the literary fiction world. And, you know, it just seemed, I mean, it was, you know, it was kind of a funny kind of off comment, you know, they were trying to shoot some red carpet type stuff.
Yeah, very similar to a conversation I was having yesterday. Yeah. Saying hippies are assholes who cosplay as nice people.
Right.
And metalheads are nice people who are cosplaying as scary monsters.
Right. So, you know, and it's, but you know, it's real world app in our our world. And, but you know, it's when you guys, you know, expound on what you do, and then that's what I'm trying to do here with the podcast, is to show that this is, you know, this is jazz. You know, this crime fiction, in particular noir and hard boiled, this is our jazz. This is our, you know, we created our kind of, say, big headed, say, our gift to the world, but it kind of is. I mean, jazz is America's gift to the world, and what we're doing is something that is eminently deeper than ass whipping for ass whipping's sake. And you know, my point of doing this. I mean, that's, you know, I started off with Gary, and even, you know, some of the more, you know, smaller scale, you know, but directed stuff like Krista Faust was doing. I heard her as a guest too, and even some of these other voices, you know, in crime like Alex Kinna, like Delia Pitts, and I had her in a show with Reed Farrell Coleman to show the juxtaposition there and how we're all part of the same family, but we're coming at it from different angles. And I'm so excited that you guys can come on and just expound on that and explain that and just as exemplars of what I'm trying to show, because on the surface, some people might say, you know, well, God, you know, it's all just rough and tumble shit, and it ain't, and it never was. That's the point. And even with Spillane, you know, it was slap around crazy shit, but there was something there. There was something redeeming there.
But there's also the preconceived notion. And man, I did a panel for Sisters in Crime a few years back but it was a short story editor's panel. And it was lovely. It was lovely to be invited. But this one woman in the audience was like, She's like, well, I don't submit to your magazine because it's so masculine.
Right.
And I looked at her and I was like, well, what do you mean by that? And she says, well, you know, you don't publish many women writers. I said, I actually do.
Right.
I probably 15% of our submissions, 10% of our submissions are from women writers. But 20 to 25% of the stories we publish are from female writers. So you actually have a better chance statistically of getting into the magazine. And she's like, well, your magazine presents itself as so. And I just stopped and looked at her, and she was at the time probably in her early 60s, maybe a little later. And I just looked at her, and I let her say her piece, and then I said, have you ever read it?
There you go.
Silence. She had made this complete judgment based upon aesthetic without exploring what the contents were.
Right.
And that's a lot of what we do. That's a lot of what the industry does. You know, say, don't judge a book by its cover. That's all we're doing, is judging a book by its cover. People are selling books based on pitches without having written a single word of it. It's like, what?
I know. No, that's a good thing to end on right there. I like that. Because that's really what I wanted. That's the money shot for you. Real quick from both of you, what are you guys working on now? What can we expect? Todd,
Rob,
you hit it.
Oh, no, you can go first, Todd.
All right. Nothing. Rob?
that's not true. You got stuff queued up, and there's going to be big news coming soon. But
nothing's nothing until it's something. I just recently finished a horror novel, a horror comedy novel. It has been nothing but disastrous up to this point, fighting the same fight I was with crime fiction, with, you know, pearl-clutching fucking dilettantes in horror, dealing with horror. Have people telling me you really should cut this scene? It makes us uncomfortable. Hey, Dingbat, it's horror. It's supposed to make you one.
I know. Take another pill. Take the Tuesday pill.
How many I got left?
There we go.
Well, Rob, what are you working on? Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's it. Yeah.
Rob, what are you working on?
So right now, I'm doing edits for the fourth Assassin's novel. It's going to come out next summer, and then I'm writing a kid's book. Middle grade. It's a gift for my daughter. So we'll see. It's fantasy. It's middle grade. It's from the perspective of a 14-year-old girl. So it is a lot of stuff that I am not used to doing, but I think it's a fun one. Or is it?
Well, thank you guys. I'm gonna flash my Thuglit t-shirt again, my prized possession. I'm not gonna give it to KT Nguyen again because she didn't give it back to me for like a month. She's probably walking around the house, and, you know, or maybe polishing the windows with it. Thank you guys. Yes, it is, and I'm going to make sure it's going to be like that flag in that Star Trek episode, the Eplebnista one with the Kongs and the Yangs. I'm going to have that. Guys, thank you, Big Daddy Thug, Todd Robinson, Rob Hart. Best-selling author, wonderful time. This is Chris Chambers Noir again. You can see us, our lovely faces, on YouTube. Listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and the Incandescent Radio Network. Thank you guys so much, and we're out.
Thank you for having us, brother.
Thank you all. We'll see you all soon on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, proud producer of the show. Check out ChrisChambersNoir.com for all the good information. We'll talk to y'all soon.